Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Today, we're opening up talking about a really important subject for the very first time on our program, parentage, and how Connecticut's We Care Coalition and one Yale professor is championing proposed legislation that will ensure access to legal parenthood for all children, including those with unmarried, same-sex, or non-biological parents. Then we're going to meet the president of the Connecticut Psychological Association to discuss how the COVID pandemic is taking a toll on our mental health by increasing stress, anxiety, and depression, particularly among certain populations, and how you can address it immediately and access help or support. And we'll close helping young people in our state better map their future careers and arrive in the workforce equipped to succeed as we tout and tell students and businesses about junior achievement of Greater Fairfield County's upcoming Inspire Virtual Career Exploration Fair. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Does imaging at the time of new onset diabetes lead to earlier detection of pancreatic cancer? This is the question the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, or PanCAN, hopes to answer through its Early Detection Initiative, the largest forward-looking clinical trial of its kind, aiming to develop an early detection strategy for pancreatic cancer. With generous continued donor funding, PanCAN plans to invest $25 million into the trial, which will study people over age 50 with new onset diabetes. Because pancreatic cancer doesn't have a routine screening test like colonoscopies or mammograms, most patients are diagnosed after the disease is spread, and that limits treatment options. Earlier detection leads to more options and improved survival. To learn more and support this groundbreaking new research, just visit pancan.org. Well, we're introducing a brand new subject here on the award-winning For the People. Just when you thought we scoured the world and covered everything, I'm so pleased to make a new friend this morning, Professor Douglas Njeem, who's one of the leaders of the We Care Coalition. He's a Yale law professor who's been focusing on the issue of parentage, both here in Connecticut, predominantly here in Connecticut, but also across the country. So pleased to say, on the last couple of days of March and on the heels of a powerful hearing earlier that month where Connecticut families called on lawmakers to reform state parentage law, the Connecticut Judiciary Committee passed the Connecticut Parentage Act on a consent out of committee. And this HB 6321 proposal would overhaul existing state laws to ensure that all Connecticut children, regardless of the circumstances of their birth or their marital status, gender, or sexual orientation of their parents, have equal access to the security of a legal parent-child relationship. This is really one of the most basic and important components of family dynamics and really the kind of social and maybe even the mental health of the people involved. Doug, tell us a little bit first more about yourself and how you got into this issue and decided to make it a national focus.
Yeah, so thank you for having me. I'm a law professor at Yale and actually grew up in Connecticut and so returned back here a few years ago to join the faculty. And I teach and write about family law and constitutional law. And in family law, there is this concept called parentage, which is just the legal recognition of the parent-child relationship. And most people just take it for granted that they are a parent of their child. But as someone who studies in the area, there are a lot of cases in which people are living their lives parenting their children. And when some crisis hits, they find out that the law actually doesn't treat them as a parent of their child. Mm-hmm. And I just became intensely interested in these cases and the people that were being burdened by them and the children that were being harmed by these cases, which exists across the country. And so have been very involved over the past several years in efforts around the country and in Connecticut to reform our laws so that people's parent-child relationships are protected and secure.
So are there other places on this planet that are very forward thinking to the extent that they could really set an example both for Connecticut or any other state or entity that is looking to strengthen the access to the security of this legal parent-child relationship?
Yeah, so importantly, parentage is regulated at the state level because it's a family law question.
In the U.S.?
In the U.S., yeah. So our state courts and state legislatures that that do this. And so the U.S. is sort of a patchwork. And you have states like California and Washington and Maine and Vermont and Rhode Island that have been really leading in this area and have reformed their laws. And you also have what's called the Uniform Parentage Act, which came out in 2017 from the Uniform Law Commission, which is a nonpartisan group of scholars and lawyers and judges, state court judges and state lawmakers that produced this model act that states have begun to adopt. That's really the sort of state of the art best practices on this.
So it serves would serve as a template for states
exactly
that do. Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, so we've used that in Connecticut as the template, and we've then adapted it to the specifics of Connecticut's practices and procedures and laws.
Are there any other countries that have really, you know, led the charge in this area long before the United States and this this think tank, so to speak, developed this template?
Yeah, so so I should say that the U.S. has actually been a real leader on family law that's more inclusive, and especially that includes LGBTQ parents and their children. But our neighbors to the north, Canada, have also been real leaders on this. And so in Canada, parentage is regulated at the provincial level. And in Ontario and Quebec and British Columbia, they have adopted very inclusive parentage laws, and their courts have made decisions that also include children of same-sex couples and children conceived through assisted reproduction.
Okay. Well, I Doug, we really kind of dove into the deep end with the beginning of this conversation. Maybe we should kind of things back a little bit and just try to set up a couple of two or three common scenarios that the that HB 6321 is working to address. What are some situations that people might be familiar with that would be impacted if this bill is successful?
Yeah, so I mean, we actually can just draw from the real world. My main partner in this legislative effort is GLAAD, which is a LGBTQ legal organization that handles work in New England, and they have people who, you know, call them all the time who deal with these problems. So one example would be a female same-sex couple, and they use donor sperm to conceive a child. And they both intend to be the parents of that child, and they have the child. But if they are unmarried, only the birth mother's name goes on the birth certificate. Only the birth mother is treated as a legal parent. And the only way for the other, the non-biological mother, to be treated as a legal parent is to adopt her own child, which is an expensive and lengthy an invasive process. And so there are a lot of same-sex couples in Connecticut right now in which two women are raising their child together, but one of those women does not have the legal security of parentage, and the child, importantly, does not have the legal security of parentage. So if the birth mother is incapacitated or something happens, the child has no right to be with the other parent. So that's one situation that would change with our bill. And what our bill would do is it would treat both women as legal parents because they went through the reproductive process together with the intent to be the legal parents of the child. And we treat them as the parents. And instead of having to adopt, we allow them to sign what's called an acknowledgement of parentage that will establish their parental status and also allow them to go on the birth certificate. Okay. So right now in Connecticut, when an unmarried woman gives birth to a child, she is presented with an acknowledgement of paternity in which she and the man who says he's the biological father can sign to establish his parentage. And we would make that simple form that hospitals administer available to same-sex couples and to other parents who are having children through assisted reproduction.
Okay.
So that they can just easily establish their parentage upon the birth of their child.
Are there any more or other unique situations that may impact far fewer individuals and families here in Connecticut, but nonetheless would yeah. fall under the protections of this new legislation?
Yeah, so we also in the bill have a concept called de facto parentage, which exists now in many, many states, including most of the states around us. Mm-hmm. So if someone comes into a child's life after the birth of the child, but they are parenting the child and the child views them as their parent, and with the support of the other parent, they form this parent-child relationship,
mm-hmm.
That person could be recognized as a parent of the child. Whereas right now in Connecticut, that person is a legal stranger to the child. And so this is really why it's so important for children, because from children's perspective, they don't know, it doesn't matter to them whether the person is their biological parent, whether the person's married to the other parent. What they care about is this person my parent? What my colleagues at Yale at the medical school call psychological parent. And our law would treat that person as a parent and allow them to petition a court to issue a judgment that renders them a parent and also then put them on the birth certificate.
Okay. And does the tenet about gender-specific language also come into play?
Yeah. So the other thing our bill does is it makes the parentage law gender neutral. So for Connecticut law, for example, if you look at our statutes, they still use the term husband and wife. So our law, for instance, says if a married woman gives birth to a child conceived with donor sperm, her husband is treated as the father.
Uh-huh.
And instead, our bill is going to say the individual who's married to the person who gives birth uh-huh. is treated as a parent. And so it includes same-sex couples through gender-neutral language and no longer uses these terms maternity and paternity.
Oh, okay. Great. Well, thanks for that clarification. We've got a couple yeah. more minutes with Professor Douglas Nijame, who is a leader of the We Care Coalition and a Yale law professor with a specialty focus on parentage. He was one of the leaders behind the recent introduction of legislation in the current session, HB 6321. So, Doug, I guess in the last few minutes that we have with you as we speak today, and we know things could even kind of change on a dime because the session is happening. Where does HB 6321 stand now, and how could you tap into the advocacy of our listeners who found one or more of the points of this bill resonating with someone they love or care about?
Yeah. So thanks for asking that. So, right now, the bill is calendared in the full House. So as you reported, it was voted out of the Judiciary Committee, and the Legislative Commissioner's Office has reported the bill out actually as of today to the House floor. So it goes to the screening committee in the House and then will eventually get voted on in the House and hopefully then move to the Senate. It would be it's really important if people who support this effort and are affected by it in various ways, reach out to their lawmakers. And so you can find out more about the We Care Coalition and about the Connecticut Parentage Act by going to Yale's our webpage on the Yale website, which is law.yale.edu/CPA. Again, that's law.yale.edu/CPA. And we have on there links to writing your legislator in support of the Connecticut Parentage Act, and links as well to find who your representative and senator are, and you can then write to them and tell them why this is an important bill. We're very pleased that this bill has bipartisan support. There are Democrats and Republicans from the House and the Senate that are supportive of this bill. It's being led by Representative Jeff Curry and Senator Alex Kasser, but there are many others who have stepped forward to support this important effort. And the more that lawmakers hear from their constituents about this, the more likely they are to see how critical it is to the health and security of families and children in Connecticut.
Excellent. Folks, HB 6321, as you hear, which could imminently appear on the floor of the General Assembly, would overhaul existing state law to ensure that all Connecticut children, regardless of the circumstances of their birth or their marital status, gender, or sexual orientation of their parents, have equal access to the security of a legal parent-child relationship. If you'd like to learn more about it or find out how you can communicate with a lawmaker, your state representatives and senators, then you can learn more about how you can play a role in bringing Connecticut into modern day in relationship to parentage law by ensuring access to legal parenthood for all children, including those with unmarried, same-sex, or non-biological parents. Law.yale.edu/EPA is the website to go.
CPA.
CTA. Good. Thank you.
CPA for Connecticut Parentage Act.
Got it. We want to thank you, Professor Douglas Njame, for your incredible work here, including helping draft this legislation. And we hope that folks will be responsive to it and Connecticut can become one of these other leading states across the country to draft this legislation. Thank you so much for your time this morning. And we learned a lot. And we hope our listeners can go to work in making sure that Connecticut joins the national leadership in this issue. So thanks.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity.
Well, I was just talking with our midpoint guest this morning, Dr. Jennifer Doran, who's president of the Connecticut Psychological Association, that it's been a really long time since we were able to focus on her organization, on the program. And I'm so glad we're kind of back in the swing of things because Dr. Doran and her group and many of the professionals affiliated with it have been really dealing with a tsunami of escalation in concerns with individuals, especially through the pandemic, going back a little over a year. So I just want to tell you that the Connecticut Psychological Association was formed to further the development and usefulness of psychology as a science, as a profession, and as a means of promoting human welfare. And they want to provide opportunities for students pursuing training in psychology to become more fully engaged in the standards, interests, and collegiality of the profession. We also really want to work at continuing our mission to break down stigmas and to avail people of the kind of support and make them feel comfortable about seeking it, even if they think they may not need it. Better to rule out than to have concerns or an issue and not be able to access the appropriate treatment or support for that. Right, Jen?
Absolutely. Well said.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being part of the program. So without further ado and beyond that brief introduction, let's talk a little bit more about CPA and what it is, what you're doing to help support individuals and their caregivers throughout this pandemic.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on. Very happy to be here. So one of the major things that we do and that we're doing a lot of now is really focusing on advocacy. There continue to be so many access to care issues, just a lack of services, a lack of ways to find services for people who are kind of struggling now more than ever. And we're doing a lot of advocacy both at home and in Connecticut and also nationally. Recently, you know, did a bunch of national Hill visits just last month where we're really promoting for continuation of the provisions that are in place for telehealth services, including allowing people to access mental health care over the phone where that is the, you know, only and best option for them. Trying to, you know, fight for payment parity and, you know, appropriate reimbursement so that, you know, providers will take insurance, which, you know, they don't all because of the reimbursement rate issues, you know, just to kind of help increase access to care and ensure that everyone can get, you know, the help that they need right now. Another big piece of what we do legislatively is really advocate for policies and action that are, you know, socially conscious and promote social justice issues and equity, diversity, and inclusion. A big thing that we're focusing on right now.
Well, let me stop you on that one because it has also been a relatively new area of focus for the people in terms of racial and social justice and equity. When we hear about things like COVID vaccines and other things that are happening here during the pandemic, we continue to hear how certain minority groups are substantially more affected. How is that reflected in the numbers that you are determining in terms of folks needing mental health support during this pandemic? Are there certain ethnic or minority groups or socioeconomic classes that are you're seeing are predominantly more impacted?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, pre-pandemic on a good day, right, there is a health equity problem in our society and in our healthcare system. And what the pandemic has done is just sort of greatly exacerbated the inequities that exist and how difficult it really is for, you know, people from lower socioeconomic status backgrounds and especially, you know, any minority or marginalized identity. So the pandemic has sort of exacerbated those things, and that's all separate from and kind of piled on top of the, you know, systemic racism that we can continue to see and, you know, identity-based, you know, violence and aggression that has a great, great impact on our diverse communities. So when you put all that together, it really is kind of a perfect storm. And, you know, kind of the most vulnerable among us are, you know, kind of in the worst position now as well, and with things kind of escalating. So very, very concerning to us.
Yeah. How about in terms of the current legislative session in Hartford and the advocacy and programming that you're trying to support that may already be in place under an executive order? I understand telehealth is a big area that a lot of legislators are thinking about in terms of, you know, creating provisions to significantly broaden this. And it seems like utilizing telehealth, especially for psychological and mental health support, is an exceptional vehicle to deliver those services with great immediacy, but with that still providing that face-to-face personal contact, however virtual.
Absolutely. Telehealth has been a game changer and has really allowed for an expansion of mental health care in terms of specialty, in terms of access. Helps to reduce stigma, makes care easier, you know, when it's difficult because of finances, work, travel, things like that. It is also true, though, that millions of Americans still, you know, don't have access to, you know, broadband internet and high-speed Wi-Fi, and this is most true in our rural and underserved communities. So, you know, we have this great tool that works less well in, again, like some of the communities who need the support more. So some of what we're really advocating for, again, like in Hartford and nationally, is really to, you know, have mental health care be more flexible. Audio-only care is an example of this. If someone has no other option and can't access, you know, reliable Wi-Fi and, you know, that the connection's just not stable enough to do the kind of Yeah, to do video conferencing, right? Like, can they do audio care, you know, from their car if they need to, if they don't have, you know, a private environment otherwise, and have that be covered by insurance so that there's some way for them to get support and get the care that they need. Mm. So a lot of advocacy has been focused on issues like that, you know, telehealth generally, absolutely, for face-to-face video conferencing, and then things like audio-only care and payment parity so that everyone can get the help that they need right now.
Great. Switching gears to another component of the CPA's mission, in terms of public education, I think probably finally on this subject, the most important thing you might be able to explain and clarify to everyone listening this morning is, and on our podcast, whenever you're listening, is the difference between psychologists and counselors or, other individuals who utilize components of psychology, but they do not have that actual academic and professional designation?
Absolutely. So psychologists and psychiatrists are the only doctoral level mental health providers with really advanced knowledge and specialized training in terms of mental health conditions and assessment and evidence-based practices for treating them. Not at all to devalue, other providers and other therapists, but, you know, psychology is sort of a highly specialized thing, and psychologists are the doctor level provider that's going to provide behavioral health care, psychotherapy, things like that. Psychiatrists are our medical doctors who will do medication, right? Psychopharmacological treatment for mental health conditions. But psychologists and psychiatrists are really at that doctoral level and have the most advanced, specialized training in mental health conditions and issues.
Great. Before we go into the break, Dr. Doran, please let's move on to fallout from the pandemic. And then after the break, we'll talk a little bit about warning signs and steps to help oneself, as well as providing some resources for folks where they can go for some support or assistance. What are the couple of top bullet points that keep you up at night when it comes to how the COVID-19 pandemic is impacting the overall mental health of our citizens here in Connecticut?
Yeah, I think, you know, something a colleague of mine said to me this morning, that what something that he shares in his practice is, you know, everything is just 30% worse right now, you know, kind of anecdotally, right? Like if you were depressed before the pandemic, your depression's worse. If you were anxious, your anxiety's worse. Things are, you know, if you didn't have problems before, you probably have some now, right? Things are incredibly stressful. And some of that is normal because of what we're going through, right? Like you would expect, you know, feeling sad, feeling anxious, things like that. But there are also so many stressors going on that it really kind of compounds and becomes difficult to deal with. Mental health conditions are up. Symptoms are up. Substance use is up. Interpersonal violence is up. Calls to suicide hotlines are up, right? All of these things are kind of trending upwards at rates that are really concerning and really alarming. And, you know, trying always to expand access to care as much as we can. Providers are busy. Providers are full. They're doing even more than they're used to doing because there's just so much demand for help and support and, you know, mental health care at this time. Okay. Health care claims for mental health are up more than double in most areas.
Well, we're going to give you a quick break to take a breath. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back to talk more with Dr. Jennifer Doran. She's the president of the Connecticut Psychological Association, also works very closely with the VA here in Connecticut, and is a professor at the Yale School of Medicine's Department of Psychiatry. We'll be coming back to talk a little bit about depression versus anxiety. We'll identify some warning signs you may be already seeing in someone that you love or feeling yourself, and then some ideas about how to improve your mood and resources where you can go if you need help. We'll be back. Stay with us. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. With many residents still working from home in Connecticut this spring, more DIY projects out and around your property are underway, which can bring the danger of exposure to hits on vital public utility lines with them. April is National Safe Digging Month, and here in Connecticut, we're celebrating Call Before You Dig, and we're here to remind you that digging without knowing what's below the surface risks causing property damage, injury, and even death. Call Before You Dig, a nonprofit safety call center in Hamden, wants Connecticut homeowners and contractors to be advised about this critical public safety practice. Just go to cbyd.com for an e-ticket or call 811 at least two full working days before digging during construction projects and yard improvements this season. Don't forget, it's the law and it's absolutely free. CBYD.com or call 811 for Call Before You Dig. We're back with Dr. Jennifer Doran. She's president of the Connecticut Psychological Association. As we mentioned before the break, she is also working very closely with the VA here in Connecticut, and she is affiliated as a professor with the Yale School of Medicine's Department of Psychiatry. We're really, really honored to have you, Jennifer, coming in and talking this morning. So let's quickly just dig into clarifying the difference. When we say anxiety versus depression, according to some of the data that you sent me, it appears depression is growing in prevalence during this COVID pandemic, according to the CDC, where anxiety prevalence is just slightly less. Just give us a quick thumbnail on what the difference is.
Yes. So when we're talking about depression, what we're really talking about is kind of just a decrease in mood, just feeling down, feeling not quite right, not quite yourself. When you're depressed, it sort of feels like there's just this dark cloud hanging over you, and things that used to make you smile, that you used to enjoy, become harder, right? You don't feel totally present. You're not quite there. They don't feel as positive or as joyful as they used to for you. And really just kind of losing interest or pleasure in the things that you used to enjoy is one of the hallmark symptoms of depression, as well as, you know, changes in eating or sleep, trouble concentrating, crying, just feeling a lack of motivation, negative thoughts about yourself, all of these things, kind of represent what depression typically looks like.
So if people see this in themselves, that they would technically be falling under the classic warning signs.
Yeah. If you're noticing any of those symptoms, right? And again, like some degree of symptoms is normal right now. That's a normal and appropriate response to what we're going through. But it really becomes about when you can't kind of break out of that, when that starts to become pretty, you know, chronic and permanent, when you're just isolating and withdrawing, if that's going on for a period of time and you're having trouble, you know, feeling normal, doing the things that you used to do, that's usually the point where you'd want to, you know, seek some help, reach out. If it becomes hard to go to work, right? Hard to take care of your kids, hard to get up out of bed and go to the grocery store, right? These are things that they're really kind of signal that something more is going on that you might want to take a look at.
Very good. Also, flashing back to our kind of pullout little remarks in the first segment, I'm seeing here that there is a condition I've never heard of before, race-based stress, discrimination, and trauma, which are part of the warning signs family of things. Can you clarify that?
Yeah, so not a condition or diagnosis per se, but definitely we're seeing traumatic stress reactions in our diverse communities and our communities of color due to kind of the increasing and ever-present racial violence that we are hearing about. It really it disrupts your sense of safety, your sense of stability, you know, your sense of self, and is very kind of frightening when discrimination and, you know, this violence and the reports of this violence that are so hard, you know, to witness, especially when they're happening to your community, that really create symptoms, you know, that kind of mirror what you'd see in a post-traumatic stress disorder. A lot of fear, a lot of anxiety, anger, irritability, you know, nightmares, things like that.
Okay. Let's now look to solutions that people may be able to take to improve their mood and maybe begin to self-address some of these stresses that they're feeling that may be weighing on them, impacting their family life, their job, their sleep, their eating, their substance intake, but not to the extent that they may actually need professional guidance. Or maybe mm-hmm. they do. I guess a few important things are talking, pausing, and walking, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Talking is so powerful. That's what psychotherapy is at the core, right? It's mm-hmm. having a space and a person to talk to and to let out the stress, the fear, the anxiety, the pain, the worry, all of that stuff. You know, finding someone to talk to, fighting that urge to isolate when you're not doing well, right? Even mm-hmm. if you don't want to do it, calling a friend, calling a family member. I tell my patients all the time, like 5 minutes a day, right? Everyone has 5 minutes. I don't care how busy you are, how much you have going on, you know, do something for yourself. Even if it's 5 minutes a day, put on Google like pretty pictures and music on YouTube and sit and watch a relaxing video that's something nice to look at. Mm. You know, have pictures of kids or grandkids that make you smile, and on purpose, intentionally, for 5 minutes a day, sit down, look at those, smile, you know, find something to bring some joy, you know.
Or maybe some outtakes from the Carol Burnett show or your favorite sitcom, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Anything that will bring some joy or lightness or, you know, just make you smile or laugh. There's a lot of great apps out there. Do a breathing exercise, do a guided meditation for 5 minutes. I also, you know, I tell my patients all the time, most places that you are, there's always a bathroom. And if you become like anxious or overwhelmed, take a 5 minute fake bathroom break and just go and sit and do some deep breathing. Close your eyes, take some deep breaths, you know, look at something nice, just recenter yourself. It's so important to, on purpose, you know, do something small for yourself, get your favorite meal when you're feeling stressed out. These little things add up and really can make a difference.
And snapping off the screen, I guess, is another big useful pill to take, right?
Absolutely. Research shows that the more time that we spend on social media, the worse we feel, the more depression and anxiety we report. I also, you know, sort of jokingly prescribe to my patients social media break experiments. I tell them stay off social media or stay away from the news for a week and pay attention to your mood. Track your mood. And I will tell you, everyone comes back to me and says, I felt better. You know, and the solution is not to never watch the news or never do social media, but if you can realize that and live that for yourself and see that some of these things are having a negative impact, then you can reduce them and maybe learn different ways to use them where they're not so, you know, flooding or all consuming or negative for you.
Fantastic. Well, how do people learn more about what your organization and your members can do for them?
Absolutely. So our website is very simple, conpsych.org, conpsych.org. We have a lot of great resources, information. We have a find a provider directory. We have a mental health provider of color directory that's interdisciplinary. If it's hard to find a regular psychologist, it's really hard to find a provider, you know, with a diverse background. And, you know, so we have a list of providers of color for folks who are looking for that as well. We also help with direct referrals. If someone's stuck, if you can't find help, you know, we can put out a referral request to our community, to our listserv. That's also true for other organizations like Connecticut Psychiatric Society for Psychiatrists, right? CTPsych.org. Professional organizations are a great starting point when you're looking for providers and looking for help.
Very good. Also, there is a specific association that is only for therapists dealing with marriage and family issues, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Licensed Marriage and Family Therapist. The Connecticut group for that is CTAMFT, so Connecticut Marriage and Family Therapist. If you're having relational problems, marital problems, parenting issues, those are kind of specialists in that area as well. It takes a little bit of work to find the help that you need, but there are a lot of resources and a lot of groups out there who will kind of help you do that.
Yeah. And you did mention that for specific specialties for people of color and the BIPOC community,
You are not alone project.com. And NAMI, actually, the National Alliance for Mental Illness as well, has a phenomenal resource list page for resources for people of color and how to find providers with different diverse identities, things like that. So there are things out there, especially when you're looking for more tailored service and more specialized services.
Okay. And for members of our LGBTQ community, also a specialty site, NQTEN.com, right?
Yep. Very exactly.
Good. Excellent. Well, we thank you so much. And once again, if you are experiencing a deep depression, anxiety, any type of a mental health crisis, or someone you love is, you can always call 211 info line or the NAMI helpline at 800-950-NAMI. And we want to thank our guest this morning, Dr. Jennifer Doran, president of the Connecticut Psychological Association. We were challenged to get through a raft of important points this morning. I think we were able to cover just about all of them. Jennifer, thank you so much for your time, and best of luck to you and all your colleagues as you continue to navigate and help us all navigate the pitfalls and stresses of this global pandemic. Thanks again. Well, when last we checked in with Bernadine Vendito of a Junior Achievement of Greater Fairfield County, we are in the thick of things, to say the least. About a half a year ago, we were able to catch up and talk a little bit about how JA was navigating through the COVID era, and we still find ourselves in that COVID era, and JA of Greater Fairfield County is innovating, to say the least, pivoting to the virtual environment in a big way. And man, have we got breaking news for you. It's time for JA Inspire Virtual, a virtual career exploration fair that's running from May 4th to August 4th. So it's not one of these things where you got to go on Zoom for an hour and then catch up with the re-recording. You can take part in this virtual career exploration fair for quite a long time. And we're going to talk much more about it with Bernadine after we clear up some other questions. Bernadine, good morning. Thanks for joining us again.
Good morning, John, and thanks for having me again.
So Junior Achievement as a movement is dedicated to inspiring and preparing young people to succeed through programs focusing on things like financial literacy, work and career readiness, and entrepreneurship. And that orientation, as we have learned on so many visits with you and your counterparts with JA, can start as early as kindergarten. And in fact, JA and Greater Fairfield County's division is gotten so much traction over the years because of the way that they have been welcomed into school environments and how forward-thinking educators and administrators are seeing the practicality and effectiveness and success of your programs, especially with these younger audiences, right?
Yes, John, that is completely true. And especially at a time like this, they're finding it to be very valuable in connecting the kids with the workforce, especially now.
So as
and learning why what they do is so important now and how it's going to transcend and how it's going to translate into building their own careers and futures.
Yeah, well, we talked for a moment before we turned on the microphone about how when we were last talking, I guess everybody was pretty much virtual, and then we went to hybrid, and then a lot of systems went into fully reintegrating in a new model, then some more hybrid or virtual. Where are things right now with JA and your network of schools in Fairfield County?
Great question. So as you know, John, with just as you said, and we work with 20 different school districts, and I can tell you that all of the school districts have are different. And so what the way that we've adapted is there are very few in person, I mean, minimal. And so we've been able to provide our programs in a virtual model. And some of that will be with pre-recorded lessons and guides, which we use with the elementary schools, the pre-recorded videos. And then we have where we are training volunteers to deliver the program virtually into the classroom. And then finally, we have a series at the high school level we call Guest Speaker Series, which we have experts speaking on different topics that are relevant. And then the teachers are able to use that with the students so they are able to continue to learn and connect with the business world.
Excellent. Well, I know this JA Inspire Virtual is so critical because you and I overlap on a lot of the same circles outside our immediate world. So we're both hearing from state officials. We're hearing from company owners. We're hearing from like the Manufacturing Association and other professional groups that coalesce around various types of careers and trades. That many of them, despite the idea that there isn't much work to be had out there, many of them are claiming, especially in advanced manufacturing and other related fields and supply and support, we're hearing 2,000 to 3,000 positions going unfilled every day. And these are for jobs that are paying, you know, $50,000, $70,000 plus to individuals who finish, you know, a relatively low impact and concise training program. So I'm really, really excited to see that you're going to be able to bring the faces of a lot of these employers into the mobile devices or computers, the classrooms and living rooms of so many of these 5,000-6,000 students that you serve. Let's talk about how this virtual career exploration fair came together as a concept.
Sure. And, you know, you go to the why, and John, you pretty much said it. When we look here in our own state, we know that there's a real need for these skilled trades. And we know that we need to get it out there. So we know that from kindergarten to high school, there's got to be some kind of a bridge that connects what kids are learning, how do they build their own success plans, and then transfer jobs that really are possible. Because ultimately, what we really want is to provide economic mobility and success. Because the kids now that are in school, they're our future leaders. They're our future business. Mm-hmm. So we came to be is understanding that, as you said, junior achievement, what we've done all along for over 100 years, is really hone in on teaching those soft skills, making the connections with experiential learning, and providing the role models from the business community that give kids a real glimpse into what is work look like? What careers, what skills do you need? What are you good at and where would it fit? So with that, we know that that exists. And then with the virtual environment, JA uniquely with the national organization, and then being able to bring this to a local, locally to the importance of manufacturing, especially here in Connecticut, we're able to combine both those pieces. And for example, on a national level, this is really a movement throughout junior achievements across the country, the focus on work readiness and developing this connection from the kids learning to the workforce. So with that, we have a platform that's been developed that is consistent across junior achievement. And the way I would best describe it is like a going into a Javits Center. Mm-hmm. And then it's situated, there are different halls which represent different industries, focused on high growth areas, high demand. And giving kids, then the companies will have virtual booths, which will give kids a real exposure to what are the jobs, what are the skill sets needed, what are the characteristics needed. So this really is experiential learning that Junior Achievement has been able to do in the classroom.
Yeah.
And that's really where it came about as need.
I think what's really great, too, is you not only have very forward-thinking educators who are supporting this initiative, but as we spoke kind of earlier in the introduction, with orientation at JA starting as young as kindergarten, it's so important because in those early years, you really kind of sky's the limit. We don't know how the mindset or the talents of those individual children are going to develop, but as they do, it seems like each stage of the JA experience is giving them more concise ways that they can begin to channel their talents, their interests, and their energies so that by the time they're in high school, they can really start to lean toward the course selections and career track match, which then can lead them into college or post-high school training that will move them much more quickly and effectively and with a much broader foundation into the workspace.
Exactly. And what we're doing with this, again, it's not just a career fair. It's a real experience where the students, so these 5,000 students we're talking about are all middle and high school students. So what they will be doing is taking an assessment prior to participating, which is self-knowledge, interest, skills. So they're going into it with a little bit of an understanding already, as you alluded to. And then they are able to see, you know, from middle school, well, what are classes would I take in high school and then thereafter? Because it's so important that there's an understanding that not everyone is destined for the same track, i.e. college. There are so many, as you said, real great opportunities for success and need in these skilled trades.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, we're able with an online, and this will be a platform that is available for 3 months, so the kids can keep going back and forth too. So it's really going to be an amazing experience.
Mm-hmm.
And not just a one day. They're also going to walk away with a book, a digital career book, which combines not only their self-interest, but then information about all the companies participating, about jobs. How much do the jobs pay? What is the education required? What are the skill sets? So I think this is a really big step in connecting the needs of the workforce with what's happening in the K-12 space.
So I guess in the last minute that we have, Bernadine, the most important question to ask is if there are kids or parents or caregivers out there, grandparents, whatever, who may be listening, whose kids aren't in a school that it has a JA affiliation or partnership, can they attend this JA Inspire virtual fair? Good. BVENDITTO@ JAGFC.org.
Right.
Fantastic. We invite parents to get in touch and learn more about the JA Inspire Virtual Fair. It's going to offer students the opportunity to learn about local high growth and high demand jobs and the education required for these jobs with real insight from industry professionals for businesses. It's also a great brand exposure and a chance to build on our future workforce here in Connecticut. We hope everybody can get involved because it is running May 4th to August 4th. And we want to thank Bernadine Vendito at Junior Achievement of Greater Fairfield County for returning to talk more about it on our program today. Good luck with it, Bernadine, and we'll chat again soon. Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voket,
at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.